Today we are looking at our next part of the David series, and today we're looking at when David becomes king, and the theme of this week's talk is success, as David finally becomes king. And so, first of all, when we think about success, I mean, what is it? Obviously, success is different for different people, because we're all different, we all have different gifts, different talents, different abilities, and so success looks differently for each one of us. But one thing that success is more than is just achieving stuff or attaining stuff in itself, on its own. I don't know if anyone last week saw on the Apprentice final, there was a girl there, Jade, and she gave her business plan to Sir Alan Sugar, and this is what she tried to present to try and win the Apprentice. And her business plan was to create a new business, which would be a call center, telesales, so like ringing you up at home and finding out information and selling it on to other companies. And she was saying that this would be a really successful business, it would make lots of money, be easy to run, and, you know, achieve all the different things that Sir Alan Sugar is supposedly looking for. But when you saw in the final, you know, Lord Sugar, he wasn't interested in this at all. It didn't appeal to him. And it just shows that success is more than just creating wealth, Jade was trying to do. For Alan Sugar, he was looking for more than that. He was looking for something that would have impact, something that would make a difference, something that was a challenge, something that would have meaning and purpose for doing it. And he wasn't interested in a call center that would just make money. And so, you know, success is more than just attaining stuff, achieving stuff, and attaining wealth. And as part of the internship, we've been doing some different courses, and one of them is a Developing Courageous Leadership course. And one of the authors of this course is a man called John Maxwell, who is said to be the world's most respected leadership expert. And he's an international speaker, a well-known best-selling author, and he talks a lot about things like success and personal development and management and leadership. And there's some things I was going to share with you about what he says about success. And I was looking at his blog this week, and he just happens to have posted about it on his blog in this past week. So if you type John Maxwell into Google, you can see it there firsthand, and it's really interesting what he says. But John Maxwell says that success is a process, a journey, something that is with us through the whole of our lives. It's not something that we suddenly achieve, like we suddenly achieve this pinnacle of success or this moment of success, because obviously life goes on after that. And so he says that success is a journey that's with us throughout our whole lives, and it's a process. And he says that success, again, is different for each one of us because we're all created differently, but that there's a set of principles which can guide us in this process of success, which he says is the same for everyone. And this is what he says is a way of finding success in our lives, a successful life. He says, firstly, it's about knowing my purpose in life. And obviously, that's something that we find in our relationship with God and who he's created us to be and what we are here for. Secondly, growing to my maximum potential. And in the first week of the David series, Sarah talked about how can we live to our maximum potential in life. So it might be worth having a look over that one again. And then thirdly, sowing seeds that benefit others. Because he says that fundamentally in life, almost everything that we do involves other people. And so sowing seeds to benefit others is a life that isn't just living for myself, but actually helps other people. And the things that we achieve and the success that we have is benefits others and is shared with others and profits them as well. And I think the key thing that he talks about is this success in this way is living a fulfilled life, not just about gaining things, but living a life that feels fulfilling, not just having stuff, but reaching your purpose, your potential, and being fulfilled. And he goes further. He puts a definition to success, and this is what John Maxwell says is success for him. If he were to describe it in one sentence, he says, when those who are closest to me love me the most. And when you think about that, that's really true, isn't it? Because those who are closest to you, whether they are, you know, work colleagues or friends or family, those are the people that know you for who you are, not just for the things you have or the things that you do or, you know, your job, but they know who you for who you really are. And so for him, it's when those closest to me, those who really know me, love me the most. That for him is what success is. And Abraham Lincoln, who you can see on the bottom there, he said a similar thing. He said, I want it said of me by those who knew me the best that I always plucked a thistle and planted a flower where I thought a flower would grow. So Lincoln, a very like poetic way of saying, you know, he hopes people would remember him as someone who tried to improve the world that was around him. But the key for him is that he wants it said of me by those who knew me best. So again, those people closest to him, those relationships that he has and the people that he journeys through life with. And Maxwell goes further and says that there's two ways of looking at success, especially when working with others and like in a team or in our, you know, life working together. There's two ways of approaching success and trying to find it. And he says you can either compete or you can try and complete with those around you. And so a competing approach to success, he says, this is like a me-first approach. It thinks win-lose. So if you're going to win, then that means I lose. And if I'm going to win and I'm going to be successful, then that means that you have to lose. And it's a competing attitude. And this can exclude others, and it's single thinking. And it's thinking, you know, how can I be successful without you? And then on the other hand, you've got completing. And this is thinking not of me first, but what about the all of us first, the team, the organization, the people that I'm a part of? What's going to benefit us as a group? So it thinks team first. It develops trust, and it thinks win-win. If you win, then I win too. I celebrate your success, and I want to help you be successful. And it's a win-win situation. It includes others, and it's shared thinking. It pulls resources and works together. And so today we're going to be looking at, there's a transition of power from one king to the other, and there's a bit of a political maneuverings and all these type of things that go on between. And we're going to come across different characters in this next part of the story. And so as we look at these different characters, I want us to take like John Maxwell's criteria for success and evaluate these different characters we come across according to it and see which of these characters do we think are living successful lives and are fulfilling this criteria. So we pick up the story, first of all, from where Suzanne left it last week. And David has been on the run from Saul. He's been hiding in caves. And as we saw, he spared Saul's life twice. And after the second time of sparing Saul's life, Saul returns to Israel and turns to his base because the Philistines have launched a new attack. And Saul now has to face a new battle. And we read this in 1 Samuel 31, the last chapter of 1 Samuel. And this is what it says. Now the Philistines attacked Israel, and the men of Israel fled before them. Many were slaughtered on the slopes of Gilboa. The Philistines closed in on Saul and his sons, and they killed three of his sons, Jonathan, Abinadab, and Malchishua. The fighting grew very fierce around Saul, and the Philistine archers caught up with him and wounded him severely. Saul groaned to his armor-bearer, "Take your sword and kill me before these pagan Philistines come to run me through and taunt and torture me." But his armor-bearer was afraid and would not do it. So Saul took his own sword and fell on it. When his armor-bearer realized that Saul was dead, he fell on his own sword and died beside the king. So Saul, his three sons, his armor-bearer, and his troops all died together that same day. When the Israelites on the other side of the Jezreel Valley and beyond the Jordan saw that the Israelite army had fled and that Saul and his sons were dead, they abandoned their towns and fled. So the Philistines moved in and occupied their towns. And so Saul is killed in this battle on Mount Gilboa, and that's what you can see behind you. And so Saul comes to this end here. And David, meanwhile, is a bit further away, and he's just come back from rescuing the families of his men who got raided and captured by another band. And David has rescued them, and he's returned home in the city of Ziklag. And David's there with his men, having rescued their families, when suddenly Amalekite appears before him and runs up to him. And he shares this story of what's happened to Saul. He says that he was on the battlefield. And the Amalekite, he's got more of the story. He says that he found Saul still lying on his spear on Mount Gilboa, and that Saul pleaded with him to kill him before the Philistines would capture him. And so the Amalekite says to David that, "I killed Saul because I knew he couldn't live, and I brought to you his crown and his armband." And the Amalekite, we don't know if he's telling the truth or if he's making up his own, you know, part of the story, trying to get a reward from David. But what we see, as we saw last week, David's response is that he orders this Amalekite to be executed. And he says to him, "Were you not afraid to touch the Lord's anointed?" And David had such a respect for God that he honored Saul And he knew that this Amalekite, in killing Saul, was killing God's chosen one. And so he doesn't reward him, but in fact, he honors Saul and executes him. And you'd think that now, David, knowing that Saul was dead and having been chased by Saul and Saul, you know, being his enemy, that he might now make a speedy grab for power himself and try and rally his troops and take over the kingdom of Israel. But instead, we see further his respect and his honor for Saul. It says, David and his men tore their clothes in sorrow when they heard the news. They mourned and wept and fasted all day for Saul and his son Jonathan. And David had such respect for Saul because he knew that he was, you know, God's anointed one, and because of his love for God. And David then writes a funeral song for Saul and Jonathan. And this really reveals how Saul would be remembered. What was Saul's legacy? Thinking over Saul's kingship and his rule, how would Saul be remembered? What was his legacy? Well, David writes this, and this is how he'd be remembered. It says, "Your pride and joy, O Israel, lies dead on the hills. How the mighty have fallen. How beloved and gracious were Saul and Jonathan. They were swifter than eagles, stronger than lions. O women of Israel, weep for Saul, for he dressed you in luxurious scarlet clothing, in garments decorated with fine gold. How the mighty have fallen. Stripped of their weapons, they lie dead." And so we see Saul's legacy. How would Saul be remembered? First of all, he was a mighty warrior. He was someone who defeated his enemies on every side. And in that way, he really fulfilled the role of a king. He defeated his enemies and he brought wealth. It says, you know, he dressed you in luxurious scarlet clothing. But at the end of it all, this song starts and ends with how the mighty have fallen. And that is how Saul will be remembered. Stripped of their weapons, they lie dead. And when you look through Saul's life and you read, you know, his kingship and his rule, the tragedy for me when I read it is that it didn't have to end like that for Saul. It didn't have to be that way. Because, you know, Saul had disobeyed God and God had told him that the kingdom would be taken from him and that he would no longer be king. And Samuel made that clear when he met with Saul. And Saul, he could have redeemed his kingship in some ways, and he could have like obeyed in light of this new development. He could have, he knew that David was going to be king. And he could have nurtured David, he could have taken him under his wing, he could have strengthened him, supported him, and handed the baton over to him peacefully. You know, we saw last week with Suzanne that when David spared Saul's life, Saul shouts over to him, "And now I realize that you are surely going to be king, and that the kingdom of Israel will flourish under you." And so we see, you know, Saul knew that David would have been a good king, and that Israel would have been good under David. And he could have played a role, you know, in David's kingdom. His own son, Jonathan, said to David, "You will be king and I will be second to you." And Saul could have taken that approach as well and nurtured David, supported him, and played a great part in what David was going to do in Israel. He knew that David would be good for Israel. He could have had that win-win attitude that if David, you know, does well, then it's good for me too and it's good for Israel. And he could have fulfilled his potential in that way. And, you know, David was his son-in-law. He's a member of his own family. So this would have been, you know, this was in Saul's grasp to do. But instead, we see that he sought to compete with David. He had that win-lose attitude. If David is successful, then that means that I have been unsuccessful. And he tried to compete with David. He chased him away. And the real sad thing for me reading Saul's death is knowing that David had been the captain of Saul's bodyguard. And yet, when we see Saul die, it seems that he was isolated. It was him and his armor bearer isolated alone with no one to come in and rescue him. And, you know, David could have fulfilled that role, but he had chased him away by competing. And Saul, in his pursuit of success, you know, this is his legacy. And in the end, he leaves the country. He plunges it into civil war after his death. And that is the shape that he leaves the kingdom behind him. Because what happens next is, David now hears of Saul's death and he consults with God and he says, "What shall I do next? Shall I move back to Judah, his home tribe?" And God says, "Yes, move back to Judah." And so David moves to Hebron, which was in Judah. And there the leaders of Judah come and anoint David king over this one part of Israel. And so now again, we might think that David would now take over the kingship of Israel and finally become king. But meanwhile, while this is happening, another person grabs power and seizes power for themselves. And Abner, who was Saul's, the commander of Saul's army, takes Saul's son Ishbosheth to another city called Mahanaim, and he anoints him king over the rest of Israel. And so this creates a standoff. And on one side, over there, you can see with the crown at the city of Mahanaim, you've got Abner, who's the commander of all those loyal to Saul, and he anoints Ishbosheth, Saul's son, king there. And on the other hand, you've got Joab, who is the commander of David's armies, and he's down in Hebron with David, and you have this standoff between the two. And I've got two different film characters to represent the two characters. So I got Jack Bauer to represent Joab, because if you've ever seen 24, he is just like Joab, because Joab is like relentless, a relentless warrior, a real focus, and will not stop till he gets the job done. But he's also a bit of a loose cannon, a bit like Jack Bauer. You're not sure what he's going to do next. And then the other hand, I got Danny Archer from the film Blood Diamond, who's played by Leonardo DiCaprio, because his character, he's a mercenary. And when you watch the film, you're never quite sure whose side he's on and whether to trust him or not, or whether you can really like him or not. And this is the same with Abner. You're never quite sure where he stands. And so we got this battle between these two. But the real tragedy of this is that this is a civil war, which means that the Israelites now, after Saul's death, they've forgotten their common enemies with the Philistines and others, but they've now turned in on each other and end up fighting against their own brothers. And this is the real tragedy of what Saul leaves behind him, that the Israelites are now fighting each other. And this is played out in the first battle between the two. Abner marches his men down near David's territory in Judah at a place called Gibeon. And so Joab brings up his forces in response. And it says a fierce battle ensued that day. And Joab had two brothers, and one of them is called Abishai. And he was a keen young man, and it said he was as fast as a gazelle. And so he'd do well in the Olympics. But during this battle, he's a keen young man, and he starts pursuing after Abner, Saul's commander. And he's pursuing after them. And Abner is turning around shouting to him. He's saying, go and fight someone else. Don't run after me. Don't make me kill you. How could I ever face your brother Joab if I have to kill you? Because, of course, Abner knew that he's an experienced warrior. And if this young lad continues to chase after him, he's going to have to kill him. And he doesn't want to. You know, he knows his brother Joab. And this is a real, he's shouting back, I don't want to kill you. Fight someone else. But Abishai is relentless in his pursuit. And so in the end, Abner turns around, and with the butt of his spear, it says he thrusts it through Abishai, and it comes out the other side. And he says he stumbles and falls and dies. And Joab hears about this. He hears what Abner's done to his brother. And so he gathers all his forces, and they pursue after Abner for the rest of the day. And the battle ends when Abner and his forces, they've regrouped on top of a hill, and Joab is coming towards them, and Abner shouts down and says, when will you call off your men? Can't you see that you're fighting your own brothers? And that just sums up the real tragedy of what's going on here, that the Israelites are now fighting each other, and a civil war has ensued. And that's how that battle ends, and it's a real tragedy of what Saul leaves behind. And so Abner then, let's have a quick look at Abner and who he was. We see Abner, he stands beside throughout King Saul's life, and he was a powerful and respected leader. Even David said of him that he was a great commander. But after Saul's death, he makes a grab for power himself. When he takes Saul's son and anoints Ishbosheth king, really it seems that Abner is the one ruling through him, and he's using him as a bit of a puppet head for his own means. It says that during the civil war, Abner became a strong and powerful leader amongst Israel's forces, and so he's using Ishbosheth for his own benefit. And Ishbosheth eventually catches on to what's going on here, and he accuses Abner of sleeping with one of his father's concubines. And this was a really serious accusation and a really serious crime if Abner had done this. Because basically it showed that Abner himself was taking what was the king's, and he was taking the position of the king. And it was like treason in some ways. So this was really serious. And Abner accuses him of Ishbosheth accuses Abner of doing this, trying to usurp his own power and take the king's position. And Abner, it says, responds furiously, and he shouts at Ishbosheth, after all I've done for you, for not handing you over to David, this is how you treat me? And so that really reveals who's in power, the fact that Abner says, I could easily hand you over to David. And then he says, may God strike me if I don't do everything I can to help David get all that God has promised him. And so from here, Abner now turns sides and joins David's side. And he goes around all Israel as David's advocate, going to all the different leaders, trying to convince them to join David instead. And as he goes around, he says this to them, "For the Lord has said, I have chosen David." And so this is how Abner just suddenly turns sides like that. And so it causes us to question, what are Abner's motives here? Is he genuinely now turned in support of David? Can we really say that Abner is loyal to David now? Or, you know, is he out for his own ends? I mean, it's clear that he knew all along that David had been anointed king and that David was going to be the next king. As he says, God said, "I have chosen David." So Abner knew this. So then why does he take Ishbosheth and make him king in the first place? It's quite clear that he's trying to profit through him and trying to gain as much power as he can for himself. And then as soon as Ishbosheth calls him to account and he realizes he's on sticky ground, and as soon as he notices that during the civil war, David is becoming stronger and stronger, Saul's forces are becoming weaker and weaker, he now switches over to David's side and chances his arm with David instead. And so looking at Abner, you know, we ask, is he living a successful life? Or is he building his power and his success on shaky foundations? Okay, so Joab, on the other hand, is his enemy, if you like. Joab, like I said, he is just, for me, just like Jack Bauer, and he is a fascinating character. He is literally relentless, and he had immense loyalty to David. Throughout Joab's life, we see that he fought David's battles, he defended him, he counseled him, he stood up for him, he advised him. When times where David was in trouble, it looked like his men might turn against him, we see that Joab, you know, would leap in support of David and help him out. But yet, at the same time, David was wary of him. And several times throughout David's reign, he tries to get rid of Joab because he couldn't trust him. And why is that? It's because Joab was really a force unto himself. He was a liability. David said this of him. He said this about Joab and his brother. "Even though I'm the anointed king, Joab and Abishai are too strong for even me to control." And so Joab, he was a force unto himself. And we see this when he next meets with Abner. Now Abner, as we'd seen, he'd gone around all Israel talking to the different leaders, trying to convince them to join David's side. And then he meets with David and he reports to him and saying, you know, the Israelites are ready to join you. And so David has a feast with Abner and then he sends him away safely. But just after that, Joab returns and sees that, you know, David has met with Abner and he says, what are you doing letting Abner get away safely? You know, Joab's suspicious of him as well. You know, what are you doing? And so Joab sends messengers after Abner and calls him back without David's knowledge. And as Abner arrives back to where David was, it says that Joab calls him to one side as if to talk with him privately and then turns and stabs him in the stomach and gets revenge for Abner killing his brother. And so Joab, on his own authority, without David's knowledge, he murders Abner and gets revenge. But I think the real motive for what Joab was doing is that he's trying to secure his own position in David's army. Because, you know, if Abner, a great commander, joins David's side, well then where does that leave Joab, the current commander of his armies? And we see that Joab would murder again in order to secure his own position. David was going to hand over. Years later, he said to Joab's own cousin, a man called Amasa, that I will make you commander in Joab's place. And so Joab, at their next meeting, kills Amasa as well and gets him out of the way, out of the picture, to secure his own position. And so Joab, you know, much like Abner, he's competing. He's trying to secure his position, and it leads him to murder on numerous occasions. But in the end, just like Abner, this is Joab's own downfall, because David now couldn't trust him because he's, you know, a liability, a man unto himself. And years later, when David was an old man and he was on his deathbed and he's handing over the kingdom to Solomon, his son, he says to Solomon, "Get rid of Joab straight away," because David knew that he couldn't trust Joab with Solomon. He couldn't trust him with his own son because he was a liability, he was dangerous, he was disobedient, and in the end, he was out for himself and he couldn't be trusted. And so what is David's attitude in all this then? You know, how does he respond to this battle between Joab and Abner? Well, first of all, we see that he rebukes Abner. As soon as he finds out of it, he declares his own innocence and he rebukes Abner for what he's done. And he goes out of his way to preserve his reputation and his integrity. He calls the whole of Israel into mourning and he leads the procession to Abner's grave. And then it says he refused to eat all that day, the day that Abner was buried. And it says, this pleased the people very much. In fact, everything the king did pleased them. And so we see David, in all of this power struggle, continues to act honorably and with respect and with integrity. So what happens then to Ishbosheth? While all this is going on between Joab and Abner, what happens to Ishbosheth, Saul's son, who's been ruling in another city? Well, Ishbosheth had two captains who were brothers called Rechab and Baanah. And one day, while he's asleep in bed, these two brothers sneak into his house, and it says they killed him in his own sleep on his bed. And just like the Amalekite, they cut off his head and they run to David with it, hoping for a reward. And they come to David and say, you know, your enemy has died. May this happen to all of your enemies. And you think they would have learned by now how David responds to these type of things, but obviously not. They're hoping for a reward. Again, trying to grasp something for themselves. And this is David's response. This is what David says. The Lord, who saves me from all my enemies, is my witness. Someone once told me Saul is dead, thinking he was bringing me good news. But I seized him and killed him at Ziklag. That's the reward I gave him for his news. How much more shall I reward evil men who have killed an innocent man in his own house and on his own bed? Shouldn't I hold you responsible for his blood and rid the earth of you? And so we see that David refuses to involve himself in this power struggle in this way and to stoop so low as to, you know, to murder and backstab and this grasping for power, you know, in his own means. And I think the key sentence of what David says is, it's the Lord who saves me from my enemies. David, all along, he's trusting in God and he's not resorting, you know, to these murderous ways and undermining people and, you know, killing people in this way. But he trusts in God. He holds on to his integrity. And, you know, David was king of Judah 7 years before he became king of Israel. But in all that time, he keeps his eye on God's promises and he trusts in God's timing. And he remains obedient to what God says and doesn't think to, you know, take it into his own hands. And I think when you look at the lives of then Saul, Abner, and these two brothers, these captains, Rechab and Baanah, there's a real pattern that emerges with them, isn't it? I think when Saul pursues David, and he has that win-lose attitude and tries to compete with David, I think that kind of sets a culture that you see repeated throughout Saul's family now in these years coming and in his camp with Abner, Rechab, and Baanah, and how they resort to the same means that Saul did. And it's interesting, I was reading some different success books when I was preparing for this and seeing what they say about success. And one of the key themes that runs throughout them all is that they all say that resorting to backstabbing or criticizing or undermining people in those ways, it undermines what you're trying to do and it's futile and it comes to nothing in the end. And for example, Richard Templer, who wrote The Rules of Work, it says it's a definitive guide for personal success. So supposedly help you be successful in the workplace. He lays out 10 rules for being successful at work. And rule number 4 is, if you can't say anything nice, shut up. And he unpacks that with 10 points and basically says, you know, when people resort to this kind of way, it just undermines what they're trying to do. And in the end, no one wins. And we see that, don't we, in the life of Saul, Abner, Rechab, Baanah, and Joab. In the end, none of them win through the means that they have tried to gain success and gain power. And so what happens now? David, the way is now clear for David to become king. After all this, Abner has been killed, Ishbosheth has been killed, and the way is now clear for David. And it says that all the Israelite leaders came to David and asked him to be their king. And so David is crowned king over Israel at the age of 30. I'm just going to quickly highlight 3 things about David's early kingship and his rule. And I think the first thing is really significant what the Israelite leaders say to David when they come and ask him to be their king. This is what they say. In the past, when Saul was our king, you were the one who really led the forces of Israel. And this shows that You know, David had waited 15 years or so since he was secretly anointed king by Samuel as a boy to now becoming king as a man of 30. There's a long period of time. But even in that time, while he's patient and he's trusting in God and he's waiting on him, he's still acting like a king. He was living in the light of the prophetic, living in the light of what God had promised him and the purposes in his life and what he knew God had called him to do. And he was living in light of that even now whilst he was waiting. And it reminds me of a quote that, as part of the training we've been doing as interns, we've been doing this online course, and one of the pieces of advice they like to give out week after week is this: when an opportunity comes, it's too late to prepare. And so I think that's a really great quote, isn't it, to take on board. When opportunity comes, it's too late to prepare. And when you think about things that you'd like to do in the future or achieve in the future, or places like you'd like to be, or promises, or things that God has said to you, or what you feel God might want you to do with your life, when an opportunity comes, it's too late to prepare. You have to start now. You have to start now for what you see in the future. And that's what David did. And how did he do it? Well, first of all, as we've seen throughout this series, David had a real heart for God. He understood who God was, and he invested in that relationship with God, and he trusted him through thick and thin. And I just want to read to you Psalm 142, and I really love what David says in this psalm. And this is when David has been chased away, and he's hiding in the caves where we saw with Suzanne last week, and he's been chased by Saul. But listen to what he says. He says, "I cry out to the Lord. I plead for the Lord's mercy. I pour out my complaints before him and tell him all my troubles. When I am overwhelmed, you alone know the way I should turn. Wherever I go, my enemies have set traps for me. I look for someone to come and help me, but no one gives me a passing thought. No one will help me. No one cares a bit what happens to me. Then I pray to you, O Lord. I say, you are my place of refuge. You are all I really want in life. Hear my cry, for I am very low. Rescue me from my persecutors, for they are too strong for me." And it's amazing, isn't it, what David says. You know, it sums up how he's feeling, how he's being chased, persecuted, and how things seem out of his control. But even in this place, he's obedient to God. He puts his entire trust in him, and he has a full heart after God and what he wants for his life. And David, in being obedient to God, this caused him to sacrifice. You know, we see in here, no one will help me. You know, who will come and rescue me? It wasn't easy for David. He had to sacrifice, but he remained obedient to God. And he kept his integrity throughout. It's a real theme, I think, of David's life up to this point, is how he holds on to his integrity. Because it would have been easy for David to try have, you know, rallied his troops and all of his men and tried to have taken Israel by force. But he knew that, just like we see with Joab and Abner, that would have left his kingship on shaky grounds. But instead, by holding on to his integrity, David created a culture of loyalty and trust. And when we read in Chronicles, you can see about David's forces and David's mighty men. And David commanded an army of men as equally as powerful and as mighty and as, you know, like warriors like David. Any one of them could have challenged David, but yet they all remained loyal to him and served him. My favorite one is a guy called Benaiah, who was the captain of David's bodyguard. It says, "On a snowy day, he chased a lion down into a pit and killed it." So the type of feats that they could do, but yet they remained loyal to David because of the culture that he had set. And I really think that David fulfills what John Maxwell said about, up to this point in his life, success when those closest to you love you the most. I think David really shows that. Okay, so then the next thing then is, what does David do first once he's king of Israel? Well, firstly, he captures Jerusalem. He defeats the Jebusites who were living there, and he renames it the City of David, and he makes it his capital. And then the Philistines come to attack him, and it says he defeats the Philistines. Now, the Philistines, they hear that David has been anointed king, so they try and get him while he's a new king, thinking he might be vulnerable. It says, when the Philistines heard that David had been anointed king, they mobilized all their forces to capture him. And so David, he's a new king, and the Philistines, you know, they think maybe his support isn't as sure as David thinks it is, and he might be vulnerable, so they go for him at this early opportunity. And it reminds me, anyone who watches a bit of football, when a substitute goalkeeper is brought on, the commentators will always say, Or if I was a player now, I'd launch a high ball up to the goalkeeper just to test him out, see if he makes a mistake, and you can get an easy goal while he's new on the field and vulnerable. And this is what the Philistines are trying to do with David. But David, it says, he consults with God and says, shall I go out and fight them? Will you hand them over to me? And God says, yes. And so he defeats the Philistines. But then they mobilize their army again and they try and have a second crack at it. And so David, again, it says that he didn't just presume, you know, he's beaten them once and I'll do it again. But again, he goes and consults with God a second time and says, shall I go and fight them again? And God says, yes, go and fight them. But this time, don't attack them straight on, but circle around the back. And so God gives him some military tactics as well to help him. And so David defeats the Philistines a second time and he says, the Lord did it. And he gives God the glory for what he's done. And I think a key thing here that David shows is that even when things are going well, he's still consulted with God. Often we, you know, bring ourselves to God in times of difficulty, or when we're unsure about things, and we go, God, you know, what are you doing in my life? You know, how seeking God's help in that way, like when David did in the cave. But yet, even when things were going well and he'd achieved success in this way before, David brings it before God again. And he lived his life in relationship with God through the good times and the bad times. And then finally, this is one of the favorite things for me when I look at David's kingship, what he says. So David, he's established his kingdom, he's defeated the Philistines, and then it says this. And David realized that the Lord had blessed his kingdom for the sake of his people Israel. And it shows that David now is secure as the king, but he understood God and he realized that his role as the king wasn't about himself, but in fact, it was for the people of Israel. That's why God had made him successful, not for his sake, but for the people of Israel. David was thinking win-win. He was thinking he was a servant king. It wasn't about me, but it was the people that God had given him that he was responsible for. And he lived as a servant to them, and ultimately, he lived as a servant for God. And he wasn't living for himself in this way, but he was a selfless king. He realized that this was not for him, but it was for the people of Israel, and it wasn't about David. And so I think that when we look at David's life and how he becomes king, I think he lands on the complete side rather than the compete. He was trying to complete others, help others, make others successful, doing it for the benefit of the nation of Israel, not just for himself, like we see in Saul and Abner and Joab. And so then, what are the life lessons then that we learn from David? Well, I think, first of all, he kept his integrity, didn't he, throughout his all. I think that is key. You know, he trusted in God, and he didn't stoop down to the means of Joab and Abner, but he remained faithful and was obedient to God throughout this whole time and throughout this trial, really. He showed that success, or Joab and Abner showed that success at any cost isn't really success, because in the end, as we saw, nobody won when they all grasped for power. And so David, he trusted in God, and he lived in light of God's purposes and God's plans and what God had said over his life. I think if we take anything away from this morning, it's to have that, to what God has promised, what you read what God says in the Bible, what God has spoken to you, and the things that you see in your future, to live in light of it now and to act in obedience to God in those ways now, ready for whatever opportunity may come. And then finally, to have that win-win attitude like David had, to try and complete others, to benefit others, rather than having the win-lose like Saul and Abner. So those, I think, are our life lessons from David. Shall we pray? Yeah, Father, I thank you that we can read about David and see his life and how much we can learn from him. And I thank you, God, that you know you too, Jesus, were a servant king, and that you died for us and you gave your life for us, and that we are forgiven and can live a life in relationship with you just like David did. I thank you that you really are the same yesterday, today, and forever, and that we can know you like David did and put our trust in you like he did. So, Holy Spirit, I pray that you'll fill each one of us now. And as we go back, you know, into our day-to-day, I pray, God, that we would put our 100% trust in you and the things that you have for us. In Jesus' name, amen.